Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and we come your way on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We do stream live at those times at richarddugan.com, and we archive the programs, the podcasts, or at the radio shows page of the same website, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. And we also have a Facebook page, and we are on Twitter. And we do have an email address, which is TMYS, stands for Tell Me Your Story, TMYS at richarddugan.com. So please send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear what you have to say, thoughts on the programs that we're running, subjects that we're talking about, and maybe even an idea of a guest that you think might be interesting for the program, someone who has a very interesting story about how they've made a difference in their lives, and they're working on making a difference in the lives of the people around them. And it is that proverbial drop in the still water that ripples out and affects everyone around them. And it works, interestingly enough, it works both ways, whether you're trying to make this world a better place or not so much. Unfortunately, that theory still works. We also would love to hear from you in terms of your support for this program. We would love to be able to count you among those who are supporting this program financially. This is not a ploy by any means. This is a genuine request. It's just an ask. We're just asking for your support. There is a link on the homepage to PayPal where you can contribute to the broadcast because I do pay for the program myself. I remember when I was working, and I shared this many times, for a religious radio station back in Phoenix, and if I ever got my own radio program, I swore I would never, ever threaten to pull the program because we didn't have the funding. If I didn't have the funding, I'd pull the program, period. But I'm not going to sit here and go, oh my God, we have to have your support or we're going off the air. No, all we're asking for is your support. If you believe in what we're doing, if you like what we're doing, if you are a person of like mind who is trying to make a difference, trying to transform their life, we could use all the support we can get. Financially, energetically, I am open to all of it. So please, if you can do that, go to our homepage as well and contribute in that fashion, whatever fits for you. You know, we lay out a smorgasbord of subjects and interesting information, and we ask you to partake. Today is no exception. Today is Health Day. Today is Health Day, and today we're going to be traveling way across the Pacific. Well, not exactly, but at least in terms of our focus today. Our guest in studio is a local practitioner who has just completed his PhD, and his name is Brian Falk. You've probably heard him on the Santa Barbara Teen Sports radio broadcast many, many times. He works out of Carpinteria, California, and we want to welcome him. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
The whole aspect, I've used this analogy many, many times, especially about Chinese medicine. And we're going to go into a very specific focus having to do with your dissertation for your PhD. But I've often said that Chinese medicine is about 5,000 years old.
At least.
At least. Yeah. They had no FDA.
I don't think so.
Okay. They just, and I'm guessing here, correct me if I'm wrong, you know more about this than I do, and that's why we have you on the program. They just knew that it worked.
Or they experimented and tried and see and saw what didn't work,
right,
and adapted over time.
Kind of like Edison, 990 different ways, yeah, that the light bulb did not work was his response to, how many times did you fail, Tom?
I think that's how it's all been in all cultures. Yeah. You know, we use what's available and then we figure out what works and what doesn't, yeah, work. And
it wasn't you know, they were certainly not intentionally trying to hurt anybody. They were trying to help them.
Yeah, of course.
And so they just went down that path, and that's what we do. And yet then here in the United States, we have this supposed august body,
yeah,
that is determining for us.
Right.
Would you say that if I was out in the middle of nowhere and needed some kind of remedy for what ails me, I have a rash, or I have this pain, or I have this, that, or the other thing, would kinesiology, which is a modality, be of help and or support as far as my own personal well-being? I'd say, gee, you know, here's this plant. I feel like this could help me, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah. As far as kinesiology goes, as it's taught today, I don't think so.
Okay.
You'd be better off taking a little course in local medicinal plant walk, or better off going to a little survival class or survival school of learning what grows in your backyard and the trails around your neighborhood, and learning how you could use those as medicine. Okay. I don't think kinesiology is teaching that.
Not in that sense. But at the same time, the general concept of kinesiology is that your body doesn't lie to you.
Sometimes it does.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're saying, look, because I've heard this example used. You go into the grocery store and you're looking at whether it's produce or something in the middle where, the processed foods.
Yeah.
They always say, if you're trying to stay away from processed foods, shop the ends of the store.
Yeah.
The produce section, the meat section.
Yeah.
Stay away from the middle because that's not good for you.
Anything wrapped in plastic or cardboard. Or,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But you go in there and you see a piece of fruit or a vegetable or what have you, and you say, I wonder if this is good for me. And you use your method of kinesiology, yes or no. And this was the method that's how I was taught.
Okay.
Okay. That's just a yes or simple yes or no.
Gotcha.
And so anyway, well, we won't go down that road any further. Let me ask you, first of all, why does Chinese medicine in particular interest you so much? What is it that drew you to that field of study in this particular instance?
It primarily had to do with its philosophical base, its map, so to speak, its mythology, its primary assumptions of health, of how we get sick, how we get better, and then its methods or modalities of treatment. It comes from a tradition that's rooted in nature, meaning that the Chinese would observe the human body and psyche in the same way it observed its environment, the motions of the stars and the sun and the animals and plants. And so there's less of a disconnect between us as humans and our immediate environment and the cycles and changes that the earth goes through and the seasons go through. And so they, for example, pay attention to things like seasons and temperatures and directionalities and the process of growth, development, decay, and dying, and see our bodies and our lives in that context, just as nature would, is not something that's separated from that. And that type of thinking, being rooted in the principles of our natural world, resonated with me the most.
Are there any other cultural forms of medicine, Middle Eastern, European? I'm trying to think of some of the other South American, et cetera,
yeah,
that come close to that.
Of course. The first one would be Ayurvedic medicine in India. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think Ayurvedic medicine might even precede some of Chinese medicine. They certainly overlap in a lot of ways.
Do you think they actually gleaned from Ayurvedic?
I think both cultures influenced each other in the early times, but probably the Chinese have the oldest written record, especially of herbology. But there's so many similarities between them. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that they cross-linked at some point. But a lot of cultures do. In fact, I'd say most cultures, if you trace the roots back far enough, our ancestors were living amongst nature. They planted their own food. They raised animals. They were more aware of seasonal and temperature changes. And that's probably the case in almost every culture. So absolutely, I just happen to have found Chinese, and there's an established tradition in the United States where I can get a license to practice. But you could go almost anywhere, even Mexico, and the home remedies there that have been passed on from family to family is essentially the same. And there's suction cupping down there, herbology, using food as medicine, and you can go to Romania and probably find the same thing. So it's not something that's unique to China. I don't believe that's the case. So it's more about reconnecting to what we already know deep inside of ourselves, because we are from a lineage of humans that this information has been not lost, but maybe not has been present as much as it could be. But it's still it's in our bodies, and it's in the collective psyche. Just a couple hundred years ago, most people at home knew basic remedies for common ills instead of going to Rite Aid or CVS to get a cough medicine. Yeah. You know, the mom or grandmother or somebody at home would have at least a couple home remedies, and that's nothing fantastic. That's how humans have lived for a very long time.
Yeah. There's this image I have, especially out in the wilderness, even here in this country in particular, but other places as well, where you had this this small little hobble, this small little shack, if you will, and it was occupied usually by this grizzly old woman, and they referred to her as the old crone.
Yeah.
Now, that was not a denigration.
Right.
Okay, that was actually a legitimate role that this person played, and she was there, and if you had a problem, that's where you went.
Right.
You went out into the woods, into the darkness, and knocked on the door, and you'd ask, I have this issue, can you help me? And she'd come in. And she would do what she could for you.
Yeah.
And that's also, you know, that's kind of an image that I have of the old healthcare system, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, and typically there was in smaller cultures or smaller societies, villages, for example, and that's still the case today in some places, there might be one medicine man or woman or shaman to the village treating maybe 2,000 to 3,000 people in the region, or people would travel quite a long ways. I met a woman in Belize just a few years ago who served a huge region. People would travel quite a ways just to come see her because there's nobody else around. But oftentimes they weren't just the medicine doctor of the village. They were also the priest, the philosopher, the seer of things that maybe people had deep questions about. So they usually carried several different archetypal roles within them. Especially like, you know, a couple thousand years ago in Greece, for example, the shamans were, the medicine folks were very much priests in a way. And those weren't separated out. They weren't the clergy, the medicine person, the teacher, the philosopher. They weren't separated out, that one person or two people might carry all of those. And people would go to them for possession, for soul loss, for exorcism, for, you know, broken bones. The person really held a lot of multiple responsibilities, and they were usually apprenticed. They were not chosen whimsically. They were usually trained from childhood for many years and learned as much knowledge as their tribe or culture could offer them, and took on that role. So it was a very different type of position to be in, and usually their needs were taken care of food and shelter wise by the community, and so they performed a specific function, whereas now we have specialization and separations of those roles typically.
It's very interesting too that there are people today who very quietly in their communities make it known through the people that they help that they're there, but they don't advertise. They're not on Facebook. Mm-hmm. They're not on the internet. They have no website. They're just there to support you, and you hear about it by word of mouth.
Right.
And that's very safe. That's a safe way to do it, because the last thing you need, especially in this country, is somebody finding out, and the next thing you know, this person winds up behind bars because they've been quote-unquote practicing medicine without a license.
Right.
I find that phrase just in and of itself, practicing medicine.
Yeah.
I get what it means because, you know, it's sort of semantical when we start getting into that discussion. But the fact of the matter is this person is not practicing.
Right.
They know.
Right.
They've learned those wilderness techniques. There was a woman back in Phoenix that I met, and I still have the deck of cards that she created. She referred to herself as the Wild Weed Woman. And what she did was, and the reason that she did this was because in the 1991 first strike on Iraq, she noticed some refugees standing, you know, just sitting and kneeling by the side of the road, and they were all hungry. And at their knees on the ground, growing out of the ground, were these plants, and she knew what they were. and they were absolutely loaded with nutrition. Mm. But these people did not, for whatever reason, did not know that.
Yeah.
So she developed a deck of cards, playing cards, 52 of them, with pictures of different indigenous to the Southwest plants that we many of us would think of as weeds, that you could use and you could consume, or they would be medicinal and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
One in particular, and I tried this, was a tumbleweed. Now, whoever would have thought that a tumbleweed would have, A, any nutritional value, or B, that you could consume.
Right.
Well, you have to get to that tumbleweed before it dries out, while it is still green.
Uh-huh.
And you cut the last 2 inches of the ends of the spurs off. You put them in water, and you mix it in with whatever you want, potatoes, carrots, you know, and so forth. Very nutritious, and they're edible as well.
That's incredible. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't either.
Yeah.
And so these are the kinds of things that, that you know, we have sort of lost along the way because we've been depending upon the pharmaceutical companies, our doctors. We seem to put them, even though we don't intentionally do it, we do it anyway, put them up on a pedestal to the extent that we think that they have the answer to our malady.
Yeah,
and if they don't, then we're just out of luck.
Right. That's an important recognition. And I would say that just like we all have both a student and a teacher inside us that you can recognize pretty easily, like, hey, let me show you this, or, oh, I want to learn about this, that just in the same way, we have both a doctor and a patient within us. But what you just described would be what I would call splitting those two things apart when they really belong together, so that the doctor is only a doctor, that the wise, all-knowing healer, and we're the sick, dependent patient. Those the healer doctor archetype, so to speak, has been split, and the doctors play that part out just as much as the patient does. If he or she doesn't recognize and remember that they too are vulnerable to sickness, they get diseases just like anybody else, and then the patient forgets that they have an inner healer, inner doctor within them. So those things get split. And we have a lot of splits in our culture, and that's one of them. And that's a really important recognition that you just mentioned, because I'm working with that every day. We all are. To really own those two within each person, that the patient has part of them that is knowing, that has the ability to self-correct, to self-heal, that there's part of them that has wisdom, that knows what to do, a lot of times more than the doctor does, and to regain that sense of power and authority within themselves. And then on the other hand, for the doctor to recognize that they don't know everything, and that they also are vulnerable to sickness and disease, and that they need to be able to show that they're not the all-wise knowing doctors, that they make mistakes, that there's sometimes they don't know what a diagnosis is. And that keeps those things together, not split. And that's a really important thing. I hope that people start to recognize more, is that the giving up of our power and authority when we just look to a doctor or authority figures to help us.
Yeah. Let's dive into this aspect of the Chinese medicine in particular. Your dissertation, your PhD, which you have just recently achieved. Congratulations
Thank
on
you.
That.
Appreciate it.
You are the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth person that I know since moving to Santa Barbara who has gone after and gotten their PhD. I've only attended one of the defense of presentations. And my expectations were of a knockdown, drag out fight.
Yeah.
I'm right and you're wrong, you know, and then there's going to be this panel that's going to just, you know, bash you because they know more than you kind
of
thing.
But well, that's the word defense really conjures up those images that it's using war language.
Yeah.
And it used to be somewhat the case, and maybe still is in some disciplines like physics and mathematics, but it used to be that you were in a private room with your three committee members, and it was done not at the end of your dissertation, but somewhere during the middle of it. And they would question your methodology, your research approach, your findings at that point in your research. And if it wasn't up to a certain level of standards for them, they would have you go back to the drawing board and kind of redo it. Now it's different in a lot of ways, and more now it's a celebration and a ritual, because by the time you do the oral defense, you're already completed with your research. So by that point, you've done massive editing, proofreading, you've gone through many, many drafts with your three different chairs and asked to correct things. So by the time, at least my experience and a lot of other schools now, you make it to the oral defense, you've really done the defending, so to speak. And by that point, it's simply an opportunity for the student to present their research probably for the first time in public and to really walk through the threshold of moving in from student to a scholar.
And it also shows the panel that they know mm-hmm. what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Not that just because they've done the research and because they've memorized certain things, but they actually know what they're talking about. And isn't that really the point of getting a PhD in that respect, in that you are trying to, more so intellectually, evolve to the next mm-hmm. level in your evolutionary process
right.
so that you can then, in your case, go on to serve people at a higher level?
Yeah, that's the idea. PhD stands for Doctor of Philosophy. Philosophers are the lovers of wisdom. And essentially, you're using other people's work. You're gathering, collecting other people's work, and then you're adding something to it. You're making a little contribution in an area that maybe hasn't been looked at before or hasn't looked at in that such a way. You're twisting things. You're pushing things a little bit forward, but you're essentially jumping on the shoulders of giants before you, giving credit to whatever field or discipline you're working in, that you've done the literature review in that particular area. You're familiar with what has been studied and developed up until this point, and you're trying to just push it a little bit further and that make a little contribution to the field, which is not an easy thing to do, but essentially you're on the work of other people. So it's really an acknowledgement of all the scholars that came before you, and then ideally trying to contribute just a little bit to what maybe hasn't been done or hasn't been done as thoroughly or in such a way as before. And hopefully it has some meaning or value, not just to yourself, but to others and the collective.
So tell me about, and I don't know if it comes with a title or how it's defined initially. If you were to say someone, I got my PhD in, what is the name of the PhD or the title or category in which you have this Doctor of Philosophy?
So if it's a quick conversation and somebody wanted to ask and I didn't have much time to explain, I would just say I got a PhD in psychology. Well, that's true, but it's not really specific enough. There's many different types of psychology, and my degree in particular is a degree in depth psychology, DEPTH, depth as in deep, right?
Mm-hmm.
With an emphasis in somatic studies. So I'll just briefly explain both of those.
Mm-hmm.
So depth psychology, sometimes also called Jungian psychology, comes from the tradition going back to both Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud in the early part of the 20th century. And it's essentially rooted in the unconscious, the imagination, and the soul, where psychology doesn't necessarily mean the study of the mind and behavior, which is what you'd see in most textbooks and universities today, but more psychology as the study or logos of the soul. And then you have to get into what soul means. But it recognizes the existence of the unconscious, meaning things that are outside of our awareness. It gives credit to dreams and the imagination and really the images of our psyche being the primary substance or stuff of our inner world. And that's its starting point. Of course, we talk about the mind and the brain and behavior. That's all part of it, but it's really rooted in the imagination and the deep unconscious, as it's called.
What is your focus? What was the focus of your dissertation?
My focus of my dissertation was on smells or scents.
Okay.
Specifically, I wanted to find out if a scent can be qualified as a psychic image. If, as Jung proposed, that we are composed of images, that the psyche is constantly producing images, memory images, fantasy images, dream images, even our thoughts and emotions usually have an image tied with them. If that's what the substance of the psyche, as Jung proposed, I wondered, can a scent, an aroma, be a psychic image? That was my initial question. Then I wanted to, I was really curious about the experiences we have in our life of having an aroma mean something to us, and all of the memories and emotions and associations that might be connected to that particular scent. And I wanted to know how that happens, how that develops, and what does that mean to the person, to their deep psyche, to their soul, and when we sit back and reflect on that process, what are the implications to our lives, both just personally and also clinically, perhaps. So though I was working in kind of three areas, and so I brought in not just depth psychology, but I also brought in the natural sciences, of course, and olfactory research, and as well as philosophy. Those are my three domains in a kind of an interdisciplinary approach. So I was working on those different levels to answer those questions.
Okay. So in addressing those questions, those three questions, let me give you a real quick scenario.
Yeah.
And have those three questions in mind.
Sure.
To deal with this scenario.
Good.
I happen to, and again, we're talking smell here, not sight or sound, yep. Just smell.
No.
I happen to be walking past a restaurant, and suddenly I pick up the aroma, in my case it would be, of tamales steaming in a pot. Mm-hmm. And it takes me back to my grandmother's house in the summer, summers of the 60s, early 70s, when my parents would ship two of us, six, off to their place to get a reprieve from us, in a manner of speaking,
but
to give us a break, too.
Right.
And we would be there for, I guess it was usually a week, maybe 10 days, something like that.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that she did. And I can see the kitchen. I see the table. I see the assembly line she set up. My grandfather at the sink washing the peppers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What a wonderful feeling. And then, of course, that carries over into every morning that we would wake up while we were staying there, the first thing we would smell would be the Folgers coffee in the percolator wafting through the house.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my grandfather, he was a smoker, so we did, you know, that was there too.
Yeah.
And all of those different things, and the leather from all of the saddles and
beautiful.
Boots and belts, all of this. So
beautiful.
All of this imagery is coming back to me as I'm sharing this with you, and I'm amazed that it's all there.
Yeah.
What does this mean in reference to these three questions?
Yeah, great example. That's exactly what I was writing about, just that. So you were beautifully describing what I kind of, using a geography professor's terminology, this professor used the term smellscape to describe all of the smells in a landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And I twisted that around, and I wrote about what I called an inner smellscape. And you just described that. That means in your imagination, in your psyche, when you turn inward, all of the details that are related to that particular scent you just described, the room, the house, the other smells, the sights, the sounds, because smells are never by themselves. They're always connected with something else.
Mm-hmm.
So in that, it's a memory, but there's many images that are encapsulated in that inner smellscape. You described the coffee, the cigarettes, the leather, waking up in the morning. If you were to tune a little bit further to yourself, you probably remember the emotions you might have had or the feeling in your body during that time too. So there's a whole world there. There's an inner smellscape. There's a whole multiple constellation of details related to that. It's not just that one scent, but it's all of like a web. It's a cascade.
Yeah.
But it's contained within a particular time and place, and it's contained by the other components in it. The trigger was the walking by the restaurant and smelling the tamale.
Mm-hmm.
But if without the trigger, you could be in your bed at home and recall your grandmother or that time in your life, and you could, through your imagination, recall that entire inner smellscape. But it sure helps when you have the actual smell to trigger that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I, you know, both of those are possibilities. But so you described multiple images.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
mm-hmm.
The leather is its own image. The coffee is its own image. But they all were contained within a larger inner smellscape.
Yeah,
and so that would be the first part that you say, wow, there's a whole world there. There's mm-hmm. a whole world in in that. And it's experienced right now in this moment, but it, of course, occurred many, many years ago. But you could probably get right into it and feel as if it was almost happening now if you really let yourself dive into that inner world.
How does this help you in your practice? Of what benefit is this when you are working with someone?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't always come up. It has to be in the right context, of course. But it, for me, it's been the recognition that smells are part of our human experience.
Okay.
Right? Just as all the great music and conversations we've had, all the beautiful and ugly things we view with our eyes, the feeling of touch on our skin, the sense of smell is one of our human experiences, and it just keeps reminding me that it's not to be forgotten. And so sometimes in conversations with my patients, it might come up sort of a roundabout way, or it might be a centerpiece. If I'm working with somebody who maybe had a very difficult experience at home, and we're edging our way back towards working through something in the past, it could be a component in the conversation. This program is called your story.
Tell me your story.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, our sense of smell and our smell memories are a big part of those stories. It could either be the focal point of the story or a tangent, a component to it. But in getting my patients to sometimes talk about their stories, I might ask them a question, you know, well, what did your attic smell like, you know, when you were a kid, or mm-hmm. Something like that. And it adds another layer or texture to the story. In other cases, it can be very practical. If somebody's experiencing panic attacks or anxiety, I might suggest to them to find something in their house that's very comforting, like a blanket or let's say their daughter's or husband's piece of clothing, and keep it with them in their purse or their car or something, and smell that object if they're feeling sad, anxious, depressed, lonely, you know, nostalgic. And you can use that scent as comfort. I use aromatherapy a lot in my practice. Smells can be used for all kinds of things health-wise, but it's really it's helping the patient recognize and be sensitive to the world of aromas, and more specifically to their own personal relationship to smells, to pay attention to, let's say, synthetic perfumes that they're getting headaches to, or you know, paying attention to what their bed smells like, and maybe adding something pleasant before they go to sleep to help them with their insomnia. So there's all kinds of ways that one could use that. So depending on what I'm working with somebody, I might offer one of those kinds of suggestions. But essentially, it's practical in the sense of turning someone's attention more sensitively to smells and how they play a factor in our life.
Is there a way in which this is used in the healing process when you're working with someone? Or is this more of a psychological benefit for the individual so that they're maybe not so focused on whatever the malady is, the disease that they're dealing with, they've come to you for?
Yeah.
You know, I've got a lower, mm-hmm. I got a lower backache, I got a little sore. I'm not sure why, but I know that there is a blockage of the energy there.
Yeah.
So now you're going to have to do your magic, so to speak, and maybe sort of to distract me in a manner of speaking, not that your modalities are painful or anything
sure.
of that nature, but just in terms of maybe taking my mind off the pain at the moment.
Yeah, it would be in that context, it would using an aroma would be helpful simply to allow the person to relax a little better.
Okay.
Right? I mean, any type of medicine or therapy you're doing, the more relaxed you could get somebody, yeah. the better chances of a healing experience to take place. So if you can find an aroma that helps the person settle in and relax a little bit, even if it's just a little bit, I think it's going to do something.
And a lot of times you mentioned using different aromas in your practice.
Yeah.
A lot of times those aromas aren't necessarily going to trigger memories. It's just
right.
There's been scientific evidence that shows that the scent of lavender will, instill a certain sense of, and vanilla the same thing, or cinnamon, or nutmeg, or down the line. I said nutmeg because, and it suddenly flashed on, you know, it could conjure images of the holidays because nutmeg is a big spice used during the holidays.
Right.
That's interesting because even as you were sharing, all of a sudden my mind was just racing through all of these different images and the scents associated with them, having nothing to do necessarily with my grandmother and that whole experience I described earlier.
Right.
But in terms of the different situations that I found myself in over the early years, not as much in the last 20 or 30 do I recall that, but it's like when you first are hit with that aroma, there is no connection to a memory because you've never smelled it before. Let's say I was living in a cave somewhere and all of a sudden I come out and I smell tamales.
Right.
There's no association.
Right.
Other than with that very experience of the first time.
Right.
Which I couldn't tell you what it was.
Right.
All I know is that over the course of time, I smelled it again and again and again.
Yeah, so that's an important component in how our relationship to smells get developed, because typically our first encounter with the smell, especially when we're in childhood, determines our future perception of whether that smell is pleasurable or disgusting or somewhere in between.
Yeah.
The first association is usually what sticks, and it's really hard actually to change them later on.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if the first experience with an aroma is really emotional one way or the other. If it's highly pleasurable or highly disgusting, you get sick or you have a really negative experience, an emotional it's fear, disgust, hatred, something like that, and that's connected with the smell, or it's something very pleasant, pleasurable, exciting. The very beginning of your relationship to the smell is often what determines future perceptions of it. So if you've never had an experience with the smell, for example, let's say you're trying to take a test for school and you want to connect something positive with your anxiety for taking a test, let's say, you would want to choose a scent that you've never used before. That's a novel scent to make a new association to, let's say, studying or memorizing a particular test or something like that. The beginnings of our experiences with smells usually affect later on. And oftentimes we don't remember when that first moment was, but it's usually in childhood, you know. You went right away back to your childhood and your grandparents' house. And that's what I found with myself and a lot of people I interviewed with my research. When I talked about something meaningful, when you get to the meaningful, because there's a lot of scents that aren't meaningful to us, right? Somebody might have a smell of horses that means nothing to them. Another person, it means the world to them.
Yeah.
Brings them to tears.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they're very personal. And if you trace them back far enough, they're usually rooted and have their beginning in childhood.
Yeah.
Again, people, places, objects from our childhood seem to stick with us and carry us throughout our whole lives. And that seems to be a key component in all this, those early experiences.
And of course, whether you're talking about dream interpretation, whether you're talking about sights, smells, sounds, et cetera, they're all objective, but our perceptions as individuals, and there are 7.6 billion of us, there are 7.6 billion different interpretations of all of those things. And that's where the individual has to come in and start to do their own processing. And that's something we'll talk about when we come back from
break.
I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Brian Falk. Brian, what is your website?
Unifiedmedicine.com.
I like that. Unified Medicine. And we will be back in just a moment here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Don't go away.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan along with Brian Falk. He is a doctor of philosophy, I guess, is one way of putting it, huh?
Yeah. That's what a PhD is.
That's kind of cool. I mean, because I love philosophy, which is tied into mythology as well. And of course, we did a series 4 years ago with a dear friend of mine, Will Lynn, on Mythosophia, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience. We're looking forward to resurrecting that program.
Nice.
Speaking of mythology.
Yeah.
And symbolism and all of those kinds of things. You know, there were you mentioned before we went to break about the different smells that, you know, are either pleasant or not pleasant. And two came up that I thought of that most people would say, well, both of those are unpleasant.
Mm.
One is jet exhaust.
Mm-hmm.
The other is ether.
Right.
Now, where would I smell ether today? Well, if you go into maybe into an auto mechanic shop, they might be using an ether-based something or other, right? Or I've smelled some of the stuff they've used that kind of smells like ether. Awful memories of surgeries when I was a kid. And one in particular where they were putting the rubber mask over my face. And I basically, I said, oh, no, please don't. I won't. And I still remember this to this day. I told the doctor, I said, I won't play with you anymore.
Yeah.
And then the other one is a jet fuel or a jet exhaust, which is a wonderful memory, memories of travel. Which I love. I love flying.
Yeah.
I love going to the airport, getting on a plane, and going somewhere.
Yeah.
I hate coming back, but hey, it's still travel.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are the two, so to speak, diametrically opposed imagery or awarenesses. And it's just, to me, it's all really very interesting. In terms of I'm curious, we'll dive a little more into this. When did you start the process of this area of study to the conclusion of the PhD?
It started a while ago. I think in my second year of classes, which would have been back in 2013 or 2014, we had to start thinking about our potential dissertation research. We still had one more year of classes to do. It was a 2-year master's and then 3 years of classes and then the dissertation for the PhD. So somewhere in my second year, we started to brainstorm ideas for dissertation research. So it began quite a while ago. So let's say 2014. So really 4 years of daydreaming, planning, mapping, putting an outline together, and then Pacifica, the school I went to, did it in steps. So first we had a concept paper, which was about 5 or 10 pages. Then you do a proposal that's about 30 pages. And once that it's approved, then you can do your research. So it was done in steps, but really about four plus years of being obsessed with smells. And that's really where it began, because they encouraged us to do where your passion was, what your deep interest was, where you had some kind of obsession, something that was going to be, you know, you're going to be doing this for a while, so it better be something that you're really into. And that's what was beginning to happen. I was really obsessed with smells. I had gotten into essential oils. I was carrying them around with me, talking about them. And I didn't think I was going to do it on that topic, but it kept coming at me. It really, I think, chose me rather than the other way around. I'm like, well, I guess I got to do my research on this, because it keeps, you know, smells and scents keep showing up in my life, and I was fascinated by it and just kind of obsessed. I wanted to know everything about them, and that's always a good starting point with a research or a book or you know, any endeavor. When you're an artist, is you these images come to you, or these things start to press on you, and that began a while ago.
But it actually began much earlier than that, because you started your basic education obviously many years prior to that.
Right.
And then decided, or maybe you started out from the very beginning saying, I'm going down this path and I'm going to get a master's and then I'm going to get a PhD.
Yeah, that wasn't in my thinking.
Okay. Tell me
10 years ago.
How did this all begin for you, as far as a lot of folks, when they choose a career, it's either because they, like myself, have this aptitude for it. Yeah. They have this capacity for it, right?
Right.
All right. This wasn't something that, and this is the other category of people, and I know there's others as well, but these two in particular, who they had an event that happened in their lives, and they said, you know what? This happened to me. I want to help other people.
Sure.
So what was the catalyst that sent you off into the healthcare field as well? Use that wellness and healthcare.
Yeah, that's important. For me, I think it must have been around age 7 or 8. And I noticed a couple things about myself even at that age. One, that I liked helping people. I felt the best when I was doing something for others where I didn't really have anything to gain or it wasn't looking for a reward or an outcome. I just felt good to help people in even the littlest ways. Then I remember being in a hospital and feeling comfortable and kind of excited. I remember stealing like doctor gloves and little things in the doctor's office as an 8-year-old and thinking like, I could spend my time here. I like this place.
Yeah.
And that seed was planted way, way back then. And I was going through some old papers a while back and I found a little essay from when I was maybe in third grade. And it said, you know, I'm going to be a doctor when I get older. So way back then, there was some part of me that knew or had an idea of doing something in the service health field. But I didn't know what, of course, at that time. And I forgot about it all through junior high and high school. And even in college, it was sort of in the background. I just stayed open to where my interests were. But I did have a couple other experiences when I'm on the Boy Scouts, again, that had to do with service. And same thing, I really felt at my best and most joyous when I was helping people. And of course, there's a lot of ways to serve. There's many, many ways to serve. I was doing tutoring and teaching, which I love. But I felt drawn to the medicine because I wanted to use my hands, and I wanted to. I had an intellectual side that was very ravenous and hungry for knowledge, and I felt like, you know, medicine was going to support that that interest in constantly deepening my knowledge. So when I got to UCSB, the university, I made a decision that I really wanted to make medicine a career, but I didn't know at that time that it was going to be Chinese medicine by any means. In fact, I hadn't even heard of Chinese medicine. But I asked people, I did internships, I researched all the different areas in medicine that I could and tried out a lot of different things and was looking for something that was really going to blow my hair back. Nothing was really doing it. In a couple week period, I came across two different people who had just finished the School of Chinese Medicine in Santa Barbara. They said, man, if you're interested in medicine, you should really consider Chinese medicine. Went to the school, checked it out. They told me about the philosophy of the medicine, and that was like a smack on the face. And I'm like, yep, that's what I'm looking for. So again, I didn't know I was going to be into Chinese medicine, but there was an inkling early on of being in the helping profession. Once I got my license and set up my practice in Chinese medicine, I thought I was done. I'm like, I did a lot of years of schooling. I'm finished with my formal education. I got my master's degree. I got my license. I'm good. Less than a year into practice, I was getting obsessed about teaching. And it was more of not for me, but I felt I was having images of myself being in my 40s, 50s, 60s and teaching at seminars and teaching to other practitioners at a higher level. And I knew that that was going to be another component in my career. It wasn't just going to be clinical medicine. And so I'm like, if I'm going to do this at a high level, what do I need to do that? What's the highest level of education? Well, PhD. Then it was like, okay, a PhD in what? There's not a PhD in Chinese medicine, or there is, but it's not accredited as of right now. So I started doing research, and in the end, I came across a local school here, and it was in depth psychology. But again, I didn't think I would go back to school for a PhD, and it was more of something I had to do. It was like this was my path in my life that was going to be personally fulfilling, but also the work that I felt I needed to do in this lifetime was about teaching and service, and my interest in the intellectual and educative side, I think, came through with the decision to do a PhD rather than, let's say, another vocational or practical school. And so it was more of like I felt someone was pushing me from behind, like, you got to do this. Mm-hmm. And I just went with it. And in both cases, I think I got really fortunate or lucky finding Chinese medicine and then later depth psychology and somatic studies, because they both fulfilled a really big need in my life as far as my interest and capacity to help people. So it feels like they kind of found me rather than the other way around. But it was something I didn't plan on either of those, really didn't. And I tell young kids, I'm like, it's okay to not know. You don't have to have it all figured out, because if you pay attention, things will present themselves to you. People, opportunities, you know, it could be a website, something you see on Facebook, anything. If you pay attention to the images in your own psyche, they will present themselves, and you'll feel an inkling of passion or interest or stimulation that, like, oh, I need to follow this. I need to go to this place and check it out. You'll find those. And by no means I had it all figured out. Absolutely not. So.
No, I thought you did.
Yeah, right. No.
How has, and you've been practicing for?
Almost 9 years.
9 years?
Yeah.
How has this impacted your own personal health? You don't have to have specifics, but how has it changed you physically, let alone maybe psychologically, spiritually?
From the physical standpoint, I'd say that I learned a lot of ways of taking care of myself, from eating and diet to exercise, activity levels, posture, breathing, and just how I use my body and my relationship to my body with the external environment. That's on the physical level. And then more recently, getting into depth psychology, recognize the importance of the inner world, our fantasies, our dreams. I keep a dream journal next to my bed. I try to pay attention as much as I can to where my inner world is moving, the activity that's going on underneath the surface of my day-to-day world. So giving credit to my dreams more, and the fantasies that are going on in the background constantly. We're always in some kind of fantasy or mythology, the stories. And then also on the emotional level, seeing areas that I was blocked, certain emotions that I was avoiding and resisting. It challenged me and helped me in my personal relationships with my partners and then my family members, recognizing the shadow sides of my relationships, the things that were not so great in my life, being more honest with myself and my world, really recognizing the ugly side of human experience, because I tended to have a light, puer, fantasies of positive and light and that kind of stuff, and that's fine, but I was avoiding and resisting the darker side of our humanity, and that's just as important to give credit to. And so it kind of rounded me out a little bit in that way. So not just the physical side, which came kind of easy, just, you know, having studied medicine, but the other components to and the importance of symptoms and the importance of getting sick and getting depressed, and not something to be avoided or worked through, but recognizing the value in our pathologies that I didn't really have appreciation for before. I remember my first day of medicine school, I stood up arrogantly and triumphantly. I'm like, I'm suited for this because I never get sick. And again, I was splitting that doctor-patient archetype, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now I don't hold any kind of illusions towards being invincible or invulnerable. So it brought me down to my humanity more, studying all this stuff, you know.
You know, I used to say, because I didn't get sick that often, and when I did, it was horrendous in that respect. I used to say that I am not immune, but I'm not affected in the same way.
Yeah.
I don't remember, and it has to be 30 or more years since, if not grade school, that I've had a flu shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course I'm getting older, and of course I'm heading up into that category where they say I'm at a greater risk. And my bottom line is, and I'm grateful for my father's advice. I'm sure that he would disagree with my interpretation. He always said, eat, drink, and be merry in moderation, because nobody gets out of this world alive.
Yeah.
And I say, and if it's my time, it's my time.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot more that I want to do.
Yeah.
But if if today is the day, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good to go.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot that's still undone, but there's nothing I can do about that.
Right.
There really isn't.
Right.
So that's kind of my perspective, specifically in relationship to the flu shot. And I've seen too many people who they would have been better off getting the flu and allowing their bodies. I'm not thrilled with this metaphor, but it's the best one that I've heard thus far. Allowing their military to do its job, because that's what it's trained for, right. Their immune system.
Right.
Because if you don't let them go to battle every so often,
right.
They get weaker. And especially if you induce other combatants that are foreign to the body, they'll still do the job.
Yeah.
Your troops, they get weaker and weaker. And that's why we have so many immune deficiency disorders that continue to go listed.
Right.
Before we go any further, I want to let people know of some of the modalities you use. Acupuncture, herbs, diet, nutrition, dietary supplements, Asian-style body work, breathing techniques is such a simple thing. Heat, I would send them to Phoenix. cupping and moxibustion.
Yeah, it's a plant, mugwort, artemisia. It's used on the body or near the body. You burn the mugwort, and the heat and the properties of the plant go deep into the body. I don't use that too often in my clinic right now because of the smell.
Right.
But it's a classical Chinese modality. If you've ever been to an acupuncturist or a Chinese medical practitioner in like LA or something, it's pretty common. And again, it's just using dried plant and burning it.
And at the top of the list of conditions that you deal with, and this is not a complete list by any means, autoimmune deficiency, inflammation conditions. That's what's interesting, is somehow I'm making the connection that those two are very much related. I mean, they're all related. This entire list, whether it's sports injuries, gynecological, neurological, gastrointestinal, cardiovascular and postnatal care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But those top two, autoimmune disorders and inflammatory conditions.
Yeah.
What is so frustrating for me is learning about the foods that I need to stay away from that promote, if you want to put it this way, inflammation.
Right.
Because I like them.
Right.
Tomatoes. Yeah. Potatoes. And so forth. Those,
right.
I mean, I hated tomatoes as a kid growing up.
Yeah.
Maybe there was a reason for that.
Well,
but anyway,
you know, just in Peru, there's over 10,000 varieties of potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
What were the ones we got in the supermarket? What are the ones in the supermarket?
Oh, we only have two.
How many varieties we got?
Russet is one.
Yep.
And then we have the tiny little potatoes.
So it's
and so
not.
Forth.
It's not just the foods itself. It's how they're grown. The processing of them, the monoculture, growing only one crop in a farm. We've lost biodiversity. There's all food combination. There's all kinds of components. So if you just focus on one component, you're missing a lot of other pieces. Again, if you had a variety of foods and you understood food combinations and you're working with spices and we didn't overeat and we didn't eat when we're standing up or driving, there's all these things that go into creating an inflammatory environment in the body. Eating when you're upset, eating when you're not hungry, all kinds of things, drinking too much while you're eating.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to potatoes or, you know, gluten intolerances, you're talking about high consumption of poor quality, refined GMO'd grains that only recently have been developed. Our ancestors did not have these problems. They weren't over consuming highly processed crap. And so all those things make a big difference, you know.
They're buying from the shelves instead of the end of the store.
We're not growing our own food.
We're not
growing our own food. This is the most important thing. We have to get back to gardening and growing our own food and not doing monocrops. The biodiversity, you know, plants grow together.
And there's in addition to rotating of crops, if I'm not mistaken, one of the key components to the Dust Bowl was the fact that they kept growing the same thing in the same soil year after year after year after year, and it exhausted the soil.
Exactly. Soil depletion, erosion, susceptibility to pests and diseases. That's what happened in Ireland, the potato famine.
Yeah.
They're only growing one variety of potatoes. You do that, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, let me throw in a piece of information on, since you brought it up, the potato famine. It turns out that it wasn't just the problem with the crops. Apparently, there is, and folks, you're going to have to Google this to find out for sure, but I've checked this out myself. It wasn't just the bad crops. The British were also taking the potatoes for themselves.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't a question of there wasn't enough. There was more than enough.
Yep.
It was being taken from. But anyway, that's a side note. But there's one other aspect of all of that you're talking about here that I think that ties well into this. There are seasons in which certain foods grow, and there's a reason for that. And
that's
only eat the foods that are grown in our area as the seasons change, we're not putting exactly the same thing through our filtration system that gets clogged up.
That's right.
So let's say, and I'm just going to use this as an analogy, in the summertime, whatever it is that you're consuming, you might consume it all summer long.
Yes.
And then in the fall, you're going to start consuming something different that is going to start to break down the clog in the filter and open things up so that in the wintertime, you've got better flow and so forth. And the winter crops continue that process into spring and so forth and so
That's
on.
That's right.
Because really all we are, even though we're a bio, I'm trying to think of the word, biological machine. We are a filtration system that allows us then, of course, to do other things with the body that we like, you know, the work that we do and the play and so forth. And, you know, what comes to mind is my oil filter. Mm. I only put oil in and it's over and over and over again. And I have to change that filter every 3,000-5,000 miles and put new oil in there too because it gets old.
Right.
I've also found out that it also depletes. I don't have a leak, but because of where I live up on the hill, it evaporates.
Right.
So I have to keep putting more oil. But it's the same thing over and over and over again.
Yep.
And I know there might be a solution that you could put into your oil system that would maybe break down the collection that's in the filter to allow maybe the filter to last longer. I don't know that that's a wise thing because I don't know enough about it. But the body is a filter.
Yeah.
And if we rotate the crops that we're consuming over the course of 365 days, the filter can actually go on for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. And you speak true. You speak true. I think the main thing I'd like to say from all of this is that we are much more complex than we could really, I think, understand. And compared to an automobile, we're infinitely more complex.
Oh, yeah.
And when it comes to, you know, health, sickness, disease, maintaining, you know, our world and also the psyche and the world of aromas, I think because our society and our bodies are so complex, there's a need to simplify, to oversimplify, to generalize.
Mm-hmm.
What Aldous Huxley called the sins of the intellect, oversimplification, overgeneralization, and it's needed and helpful at some points. But I'd say that if we can remember the complexities of thinking in systems theory, really, we'd be doing ourselves a favor as so many different components are going into every one of our experiences. There's so much we're not aware of. And the more that we can be at least informed of these different components just within our own bodies, food-wise, and within our psyches, there's so much happening. It requires a lot more attention and less laziness to just reduce something to one simple cause or answer.
Yeah.
It's all due to inflammation. Well, that's part of it, but there's 20 other components that are going into it, right?
Yeah.
It's not just the potatoes. It's the water, the soil, the economics. There's a whole system. And I think that's the beauty of being alive and being in this world right now is we have such a diversity of and complexity within ourselves and our culture that it's exciting and there's a million topics to explore and this was just one of many.
Yeah.
And
I'm wondering the role that stress in our society plays on that whole scenario, especially in terms of inflammation, because in a manner of speaking, when you stress, doesn't your body at some level, in some fashion, in some way, seize up, tighten up, and yet and so basically basically you've blocked the flow of fluid, or you've blocked the flow of energy, or you've blocked. I mean, that is to me, and I shared this with you when we talked earlier, the lower back, which has gotten a whole lot better just because I've taken some rest.
Yeah.
That isn't just because, well, I lifted wrong or this. No, it's a block. The energy, somehow the energy flow through my back has gotten blocked.
You've been studying Chinese medicine, I take it.
No, I've been listening to you.
You spoke of the middle way too, like with food, like a little bit, okay. That was my teacher's, like the Chinese way, a little bit, okay. Mm-hmm. And then you're speaking of what I call flow and stagnation. These basic, again, basic principles in nature. Is the river flowing or is it stagnant?
Yeah.
Is our body, you know, is the blood flowing well or not? Is there blockages or not? Are we constipated? Are our dreams stagnant? You know, the sense of movement or flow. And that's how the world works. You know, where's the blockages at?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's, stress will do that. We adapt to our environment, but our constriction, when faced with a stressful situation, the stiffening, the contraction of our musculature, of our thinking, is a response to our environment. So, it makes an effect.
You know, the image of a woman hanging her laundry out on the line, and when it's all dry, she takes a towel off, and you know how they shake it and whip it to try to put some flexibility into it instead of using fabric softener or what have you. I'm thinking, gee, if someone could just grab me by the feet and just shake me a little bit and loosen everything up, it would, you know, that would help a lot.
Yeah, that's where a lot of the somatic therapies come in, like Rolfing
chiropractic, for example, which took decades to come into vogue and insurance companies would cover. And I remember back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Chiropractors were just having a devil of a time.
Yeah.
And I was actually producing a program back in the 80s with a gentleman at the station I was working for. His name was Ken Anderson. Mm. And, you know, we always talked about these kinds of, he was a chiropractor. Mm. But the way my analogy of chiropractics is you have a skeletal and a muscular system. And when the skeletal system gets out of alignment, it's because, and I use the analogy of rubber bands, they have gotten shifted around and moved and so forth to where now the system, the skeletal system and structure is not in proper alignment.
Yeah.
So with chiropractics, what it tries to do is realign on a regular basis for a period of time, realign the skeletal structure.
Right.
So the rubber bands will get back into their proper position. And over time, I've had regular treatments when I was back in Phoenix, and they really did seem to help. I mean, I still remember the first one, a chiropractor adjusted my head and all the popping.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, what the heck is that? Well, I remember when I used to crack my knuckles.
Yeah.
They would tell me that I shouldn't do that, but that I was also told that it was releasing, what is it, like the nitrogen or some gas that's between those joints that really should not necessarily be there.
Yeah.
But, there's a reason I'm doing that. It's because I'm trying to release that. I can't do that anymore because I have some inflammation from, they're calling it arthritis or whatever they want to call it. Yeah. Hate giving stuff names because then it becomes, you tend to anthropomorphize it, sorts and make it real.
Right.
And you don't want to do that.
Shaking out the laundry.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's a great image.
Exactly right.
Yeah, that's where dancing and shaking and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. As we're doing now, we're shaking.
Yeah. You notice I stood up. I can't sit in chairs for very long. I don't think chairs are a great invention, by the way. But we do them all the time in our cars and our desks and so forth. But the body, it's talking about structure.
Yeah.
Bodies is not like chairs, I'll tell you
By the way, it brings up an interesting joke about a chair. A comedian says, what would chairs look like if our knees bent the other way? Anyway,
there's a mind twist.
Exactly. Brian, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. This has been great. We are going to have you back because obviously, you know, there are a million different directions that we could go, and this is just one of them. Again, congratulations on your PhD.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
A reminder that his website is unifiedmedicine.com. I tried typing something else in and it didn't go there, but I found it. Unifiedmedicine.com. Go there, check it out. You can make appointments there and set up a time to meet with him on the phone. I would venture you probably some level of work Skype wise. Do you deal in energy work like Reiki and so forth?
I do.
You do? Yep. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, right up my alley because my wife and I are both Reiki masters going back.
Nice. That's good stuff.
Oh, 20 years almost. That's almost great. 20 years, yeah.
Yeah, very good stuff.
Before I let you go, I have three final questions for you.
Sure.
And again, my thanks to you. And I would encourage people to get in touch with you out in Carpinteria, California on the Central Coast. Phone number, which is on your website, 805-223-0915. 805-223-0915. First question is, who is Brian Falk?
I don't know how you would answer that. I don't think I could. I have no idea. I'm just, I'm here. I don't know.
Okay.
Who's Brian Falk?
All right.
Yeah.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I hope to achieve primarily an installation of passion for self-care and self-study to impart on other people. I do this on my own, and I try to return the power back to the others, that you have the ability to take your own lives in your own hands and develop within yourself. You know, I live a very fulfilling life, and I hope to inspire others to do so.
You know? And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Another one of those things. I'm here right now in the studio, and that's honestly as much as I could say. Being present wherever I happen to be, and smelling everything and touching everything, and purpose is to me moment to moment, just being really present, and
being in the now,
as if this is it right.
Okay.
Here, man.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Once again, Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
A reminder, that's unifiedmedicine.com, 805-223-0915. We will be linked to your website as well. And again, we thank you. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.